From WXXI News, it's 1370 Connection. I'm Bob Smith, and let's talk politics and media this hour. We're 13 months away from the election of a new president, but we're already talking about that election and about the individual who might emerge from the political process to be our next president. It permeates the media. It's the subject of endless advertising campaigns. So what do we make of it, and how will all the advanced talk, all the advanced hype, affect the choice we make and the result we get? We're going to ask two people who are directing a special project to consider all these questions and more. Valeria Sinclair Chapman and Stephanie Lee of the University of Rochester faculty are co-directing the University Humanities Project Special Undertaking, Politics and Media Constructions Anticipating the 2008 Election. And they join me right now here in studio. I welcome you both to the program today, and thank you very much for joining us. Good to have you with us today. This project is really broad in scope. How do you capture something as big as an understanding of how the media, the candidates, and the political process all influence each other and influence us? Ms. Chapman, I'm going to start with you on that one.
Well, I think that's exactly where we started. It's a huge question. And we organized this project in order to help us begin a conversation with Rochester citizens, with students on campus, to really address how the media influences our perceptions of candidates, how candidates strategically try to manipulate the media in order to further their own objectives, with the idea that candidates are self-interested actors. They are trying to win, and so they work with the media, sometimes tolerate them, sometimes fly them around the country as they work on their campaigns. But it is a huge question, and here we are presenting a series of speakers and films to really start a dialogue in the Rochester community about what it means, how these things work in concert.
Well, I would ask at this point, is the poor voter, us, caught in a squeeze among behemoths? I mean, think of the political establishment, big media, special interests who are providing candidates with their money, and media organizations with all their ad revenue, and... Stephanie, we just caught in the squeeze here?
Well, I think what we're trying to do is to have a forum in which to address some of those questions and to deconstruct and analyze the ways in which the media is having a profound effect on the election, first with the film series and also with a number of speakers who are coming in throughout the year.
Now, I want to talk, you mentioned films, for starters. How'd you pick them? What are you asking people to see?
Well, we began with Journeys with George, which was created by the daughter of Nancy Pelosi, Alexandra Pelosi. It came out in 2002, and it looks at George Bush's first campaign to the presidency and examines how the media, how his relationship with the media affects the ways that voters perceived him.
Now, of course, that's not going to be a totally disinterested picture. Remember, we're talking about the daughter of the Speaker of the House here. Of the opposition party to this particular president, is there going to be an agenda there?
Well, absolutely, and I think that in any type of depiction of political candidates, we have to understand that the media is always already biased, and I think that Pelosi's position as the daughter of the Speaker of the House only underscores that.
Look, if I can add something there, Nancy Pelosi also was worked for ABC, and so she was an executive producer for ABC. And what's interesting about that film, we already showed that film, I think, the end of September, and what was interesting about it is that it really portrayed George Bush in a very sympathetic light, and it showed the way that candidates actually create relationships with the reporters, and that's something that citizens don't generally think about. Once you've spent an entire year on a plane with a candidate going from these outskirts in Iowa and New Hampshire and crisscrossing around the country, it really does create an almost camp-like atmosphere, a summer camp atmosphere between these reporters. And George Bush worked it really well with his with the media so that they, in a sense, were much more favorable to him than perhaps Al Gore's media conglomerates were as they were traveling with him across the country.
Hey, you just scared me, because you know what? Are you suggesting that maybe the longer the cover a particular candidate at close range, the more they become invested in that candidate's success?
Well, perhaps. So I'm not quite saying that the media is, I'm not saying that the media is biased, even though there's lots of conversation about whether the New York Times is a more liberal paper or the Washington Times is a more conservative paper or the Wall Street Journal. We recognize those things. But my suggestion is that spending 9 months, 10 months, a year with a candidate, a year and a half by the time the entire primary season is over, it does have an effect on how reporters see their candidates. And remember that these reporters are essentially making news out of a campaign stop in a cornfield in Iowa. I mean, and so when reporters are having to, and they're waiting and hoping that maybe a candidate will slip on the ice or misspeak so that they actually can have some news. And when that happens, there's a bit of a love-hate relationship, I think, between the reporters who are covering candidates and the candidates themselves.
Are the reporters, in a way, much more identified with the political system than they used to be? I can remember when the press was dominated, at least the broadcast media were dominated, by professional long-term reporters, the Cronkites, the Morley Safers, the Harry Reasoners, the Ed Bradleys. And yet now, the current generation of media people, Tim Russert, ex-senior aide to the late Senator Moynihan, Chris Matthews, ditto, also an old Moynihan staffer, George Stephanopoulos, one of Bill Clinton's allies. The whole Fox News team basically pulled out of the first Bush administration, out of Bush 41, and to some degree out of Bush 43. And Andrea Mitchell at NBC, wife of the former Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan. I mean, there's an intimate relationship between the media and the political establishment, which didn't exist 30 or 40 years ago. Has that changed things in a fundamental way?
I think absolutely. And we have to be looking at the ways in which the media is taking on a huge political responsibility and influence in all of these types of debates. Even taking a look at, for example, the YouTube forum and how in which CNN is able to censor and decide what are the questions that are going to be asked.
And what do we know about the criteria which they use apropos of that particular recent forum?
Well, I think that they're looking for, I mean, a range of different questions, but also people who are going to look good on camera or present CNN itself in a positive light.
That raises an interesting question, which I want to put on the table in just a moment. As soon as I remind everybody that you're listening to 1370 Connection, I'm Bob Smith. We're talking about the media and the political process 2008 with two people who are looking at it very closely and presenting a series of forums and venues for us to talk about it in our community. Valeria Sinclair Chapman and Stephanie Lee of the University of Rochester, co-directing the University Humanities Project Special Undertaking Politics and Media Construction, anticipating the 2008 election. You can be a part of it all. Join in the conversation by dialing 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Those lines are right open for you, wide open right now. We'd like to hear what you have to say here in this edition of 1370 Connection. As you're looking at what the media try to do in terms of just, Stephanie, as you mentioned a moment ago, the look and feel of it, why are they doing it? What do they hope to accomplish with the way they manipulate and select just who gets on the air?
I think it's impossible for us to speculate on exactly how CNN makes its decisions. Part of this project is more about analyzing the consequences for voters and the ways in which certain types of strategies are employed both by the media and by politicians to present themselves.
What's in it for them, ultimately? Are they just looking to do what any broadcast organization would want to do, and that is build up the maximum viewership and audience in the target demo?
Well, right now we're dealing with an entirely different news cycle than was the case 30 years ago. CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, there's so many news sources and they're on 24 hours a day. And so in some sense, campaigns are kind of easy targets for soft stories to have conversations about and to really keep the airways moving. Now, in addition to that, lots of political junkies, activists, pay attention to these things very closely. So it's not without consequence. As much as I could say that political campaigns, the people who are paying attention to campaigns at this juncture, 4 months before we even began the primary season, and more than a year before the general election, the people who are paying attention to politics right now are generally activists. And they, for the most part, have very clear opinions and preferences about what's going on. And so when candidates are talking to news sources, they're really trying to, again, reach that base. And so one of the questions you asked a little bit earlier was about kind of an independent news media. And it's not so much anymore. Again, I'm not framing the news media as entirely biased, but these are people who focus on insider Washington politics, and that really frames the kinds of questions that we hear about and the ways that stories are focused, and I think that that makes a difference as well.
Does it even make a difference who owns and operates the media outlets and what their overall agenda may be? Corporate agenda.
Well, again, I don't know that I can speak to the corporate agenda of the news organizations, but I think to highlight Valeria's comment about the soft stories that are being promoted in the press is especially important. I mean, I think we're having a lot of discussions on just simply the presentation of these candidates rather than the real issues. Attention on, for example, Hillary Clinton's cackle or her cleavage rather than the details of her health care plan. And I think that's also a way for CNN and, you know, major news organizations to keep a focus on the election without boring their listeners with an actual analysis of critical issues for the nation.
Why did we get so much airtime devoted to Hillary Clinton's laugh?
Well, I think she presents a very unique candidate for our nation as a woman who is seeking the presidential office. And I think that because she's a woman, there's more leeway for the press to discuss things like her laugh or the clothes that she's wearing.
Okay. Does that mean the media collectively has got a little bit of residual sexism going on here?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Hillary Clinton is obviously not the first woman who's run for presidential office. And even if we look at one of the films that we're showing is Shirley Chisholm Unbought and Unbossed. And so that actually, when Shirley Chisholm ran for president in 1972, we had dual issues of both race and gender. In the last presidential election cycle, we had Carol Moseley Braun, who ran as a female candidate. Now, none of them had the credibility in terms of the electability of Hillary Clinton, but women routinely are scrutinized in a way that sets them apart from their male counterparts, not only in terms of the clothes that they wear or their demeanor, but also whether or not they have presidential timbre, which is generally framed as male characteristics. How strong they are, how tough they are, whether or not they walk in with their shirt sleeves rolled up, how casual and comfortable they are. And so when women are presented in kind of formal suits, or they don't have those same opportunities. They're not framed in the same ways. And another issue with female candidates just generally is that they often show up in the style pages more so than male candidates. They're often asked about recipes or children in ways that male candidates are not. And so I don't want to be broadly stereotypical, but that is generally the case.
Because nobody asked Barack Obama or Fred Thompson about his favorite chocolate chip cookie recipe.
Absolutely.
Have we got a problem in that regard as a result of the fact that those questions don't get asked to the men and do invariably get asked to the women who run?
Of course.
Well, in some ways we do, but not necessarily, because women can actually use that to their benefit. So Nancy Pelosi says, I'm a grandmother and a mother, and if I can raise 5 children and deal with all of these grandchildren, then of course I can run the country, because that's hard work. Or she says that she brings a softer side to her leadership. Women can use, in some ways, these stereotypes to their benefit strategically. But it does require careful crafting, and it puts them at a different level of scrutiny. But to be fair, we can think about news stories on Barack Obama's stylishness or the way that he speaks. And we can also think about news stories about John Edwards' hair. I mean, so, in some sense, it's not an even playing field, but it's not absolutely slanted against women.
Well, Barack Obama gets some of the same press that Bill Clinton got 16 years ago. In a lot of ways, they're being treated very similarly by the press when you come right down to it. But they are sharp-dressing, stylish, charismatic men. We're used to seeing that kind of person. It goes all the way back to Jack Kennedy, at least. We're used to that. Are we having trouble processing the fact that credible candidates now cross the gender line?
Well, I think there's also an expectation that's changed on how the candidates are to present themselves. I mean, when Bill Clinton goes on Arsenio Hall in his first campaign, he only was going to play his saxophone. And now we have candidates who routinely go on entertainment shows, and there's an expectation that they are going to be witty and funny and entertain us in the same types of ways that we would expect singers and movie stars to do that.
Like Fred Thompson announcing his candidacy with Jay Leno on The Tonight Show?
Yes, and not attending the Republican debate that night.
Probably hurt him to do that, but did it really hurt him?
No, I think he absolutely capitalized on going on The Tonight Show instead of going on the debate, and we'll see tonight how well he does. I think his strength is going to be on a television show and not on a debate, which speaks volumes to the type of people that the public is supporting.
Well, I mean, to add again with Fred Thompson, one of the issues that we see with him in tonight's debate, one is that he, in some ways, by skipping the last debate, he actually got out of the fire, right? And so now tonight, there's so much attention being paid to how well he's going to do that tomorrow's headlines aren't going to be about the issues. The issues are going to come on, you know, further down in the first section of the paper. But the headlines are going to be about how well Thompson performed. And he is already framing that discussion by saying that these other people are so much better polished than he is, and so he's lowering expectations already. And so now he just needs to do better than people expect, and he will have glowing headlines in the morning.
And this is a guy who came in as a presumed media darling with years and years and years of experience as co-star of a primetime TV series.
Well, if we think additionally, though, about the way that Thompson has been framed, right, before he ran for office, there was so much promise in Thompson running. Again, we need to, as we look at these news stories, we need to think about the fact that Thompson, by being mysterious and not declaring early, was yet another story that we could speculate about. And once he declared, then, Thompson now is being framed as lazy. Does he have the fire in him to actually win? You know, he's kind of laid back on the campaign trail, not very interested. These are all of the ways that the media is presenting him at this point. So he can only go up from there in some ways.
Our number 263 WXXI is we examine the media politics 2008 and how all these factors intend to influence the choices we're going to make just about a year from now. We're talking with U of R professors Valeria Sinclair Chapman and Stephanie Lee, who are co-directing the University Humanities Project's Politics and Media Constructions, anticipating the 2008 election, a project to examine for the benefit of the community, not only on campus but at large in the Rochester area, just all the influences that go into the outcomes of these elections and how they may be influencing us. 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Tell us how you think you're being used, manipulated, influenced, or not. Lines are open for you right now. At this stage, the candidates begin by trying to craft their own images. Can we say something about the process they try to use to build the maximum favorable image for themselves in our minds?
Well, one of the things that Stephanie and I actually, one of the things that started our whole project was a conversation about listening to Barack Obama on CD. And so The Audacity of Hope, for instance, really presents, is Barack Obama essentially having a conversation with us, but it's an entirely one-sided conversation. So it feels very intimate, and he can tell us, we can hear his kind of derisive laugh when he's being kind of, when he's kind of chuckling at himself and a mistake that he made. I remember when he talked about raising campaign funds and not wanting to make those telephone calls, and he laughs at himself. So we can get a kind of personal and intimate sense of him, except we can't ask him any questions. There's no verification of the claims that he's making in this book. So one of the ways that candidates are doing kind of this self-presentation, which is very important, is in their books that they are writing, and Barack Obama's book is more than a million books sold, bestseller, but also then in carefully controlled campaign stops, and we can think about even Hillary Clinton and the Middle Class Express, the bus, kind of taking her out of a kind of elite world. And so I think there are many ways that the candidates present themselves creatively, perhaps not so creatively. This is long-term. Candidates have been doing the same thing since political parties emerged. So,
and as an English professor, one of the things that really struck me in this campaign is how many of the candidates have published books, not just Barack Obama, but almost all of the candidates have at least a memoir or some type of documents on their leadership and their past stories. And I'm interested, too, in understanding what it means for politicians to present themselves through literary texts and how we can use the tools of literary analysis to understand those types of rhetorical strategies.
A lot of them have done that and had it done for them, too, and we'll get to that in a moment. But first, let's go to Mark in Rochester on the line at 263 WXXI. Mark, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Bob. My sinuses are a little off today, but, you know, I think that the race that we have now is typical of any other year. Everybody votes for the person that has name recognition and the money. The most name recognition, the most money. Take a look at who the front runners are. And when you take a look at, Hillary Clinton, she's there because she's not Hillary Smith. You know, she wasn't married to Bob Smith. She was married to Bill Clinton. And you take a look up and down the line, are the president we have now, whether people like him or hate him, was there because Bush is a family name that everybody knows. And we see that with local politics. And unfortunately, the voters should take a look at some of the lesser-known people. It was kind of interesting that Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich both said that Mike Huckleberry of Arkansas was probably the best Republican candidate, as they thought would be the best, even though nobody knows him now. Duncan Hunter has been, nobody knows who he is. He's a right-wing congressman from South of Southern California. He is talking like Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan and Ross Perot about, you know, free trade versus fair trade, which is one of the debate topics today. And of course, he's, you know, for the working American, just like John Edwards, but nobody ever heard of him, you know. And when you take a look at whether it's Hillary Clinton or all the front runners, and they're getting money from Wall Street, they're getting money from the big insurance companies, it's a popularity contest. It's really not an issues contest, and it's very unfortunate, but the voters, you know, they look at it as a horse race and a popularity contest, and we're all going to be worse off for that.
Reactions from our panel?
I understand what the caller is saying. Name recognition is probably the most important factor for a candidate in terms of, particularly in the early stages of a campaign. Name recognition can certainly make a candidate a front runner and keep them in that status. There's a quote that I read recently that the 2008 presidential campaign is a contest of the rich and already famous, right? So these candidates have celebrity status, many of them, the front runners do. From Giuliani, Clinton, and Barack Obama, John Edwards as well, McCain as well. But we see with someone like McCain, I think is a good example, that name recognition is not the only factor in terms of moving candidates to the front and keeping them there. But I do sympathize with the caller in terms of the fact that as voters, there's so many, one of the benefits of so many media outlets now is that citizens can actually get much more information. One of the ways that candidates present themselves, too, in a very controlled fashion is through their internet websites. And so while these are very controlled in terms of what they present, they also can contain quite a bit of information about where the candidates stand on various issues from health care to the economy to the war in Iraq.
Chris, it is true that a few years ago, Barack Obama, while he was well known in Illinois because people who follow statewide politics had seen his track record in the Illinois legislature, nobody outside of Illinois knew who he was until he got up on that rostrum and made that speech. Are there defining moments where somebody can just bust through and become an instant national celebrity by reaching out and grabbing people by the collar?
Well, I think that Barack Obama, his prominence is also going to be influenced and helped by the fact that Oprah Winfrey has endorsed him. And I think we have to look very carefully in the ways in which her approval of him is going to better his chances. I think that although we've definitely seen celebrity endorsements promote candidates, Oprah is unique in that, unlike an endorsement from George Clooney or Sean Penn, Oprah is not selling movies. She's selling an entire lifestyle, and so I think that her endorsement could have consequences well beyond what we've seen previously.
Although a lot of her fan base, women 25 to 54, are really strongly embracing Hillary Clinton. What's going on there?
But we haven't yet seen what are the effects of Oprah's endorsement, and also not just, I mean, financially she can raise a lot of money for him, but if she promotes him on her show and brings Michelle and Obama on the Barack Obama onto her program, perhaps she will sway her audience significantly.
Well, and if I can add, what she does at least by having Michelle and Barack Obama on her show is, in some ways, an hour-long free advertisement, right? So it gets Barack Obama into people's living rooms yet again. It might not change minds. You know, I think many people have already made up their minds and are likely to vote eventually for whoever is in the lead coming out of Iowa or New Hampshire or, you know, the early January primaries and caucuses. But I do think one of the critiques lately of Oprah Winfrey, in line of what Stephanie just raised, is that Barack Obama didn't raise as much money as Hillary Clinton in the second quarter. And so now there's speculation that maybe Oprah's endorsement wasn't so important. But I think that the point that you raised about the fact that Barack Obama was a virtual unknown up until the 2004 Democratic Convention, beyond the fact that Oprah has endorsed him and that he has, I think, nationwide appeal, not nearly as strong as Clinton at this point, as Hillary at this point, but still nationwide appeal, is that Barack Obama is charismatic. I mean, so immediately, when he started even hinting that he might run for president, there were allusions to Camelot and the Kennedy family and all of these things. So I think that he has a lot going for him independently, and he has a juggernaut in terms of fundraising, both on the internet and kind of bundling and the resources that Oprah Winfrey can bring together. But I mean, I agree, I think, with the points about Obama and his unknown status.
We're going to get back to more of that in just a moment, but first we must take a short break. Then we will return. You of our faculty members, Valeria Sinclair Chapman and Stephanie Lee, are helping us understand the interplay of media, politics, and the election campaigns with us and how it all may influence and cross-pollinate. I'm Bob Smith. 1370 Connection on WXXI resumes in just a moment. 1370 Connection continues on WXXI. I'm Bob Smith. You're invited to be a part of the conversation at 263-WXXI, 263-9994. A few of our professors, Valeria Sinclair Chapman and Stephanie Lee, are here with us right now. They are co-directors of the University Humanities Project Special Undertaking, Politics and Media Construction, Anticipating the 2008 Election, Understanding How Media, Images, Publicity, Advertising, so many messages interplay with us, may very well drive what we do this coming November 8th of 2008. 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We talk about the talk shows. Which ones make a difference? Does it make more of a difference that Barack Obama is featured on Oprah, that Hillary Clinton seems to be not exactly a semi-regular, but close to it on the Letterman show, that the Hollywood connection of candidates from Arnold Schwarzenegger to Fred Thompson are prominent on Jay Leno, or that they all, for some reason or other, get attention, whether they want it or not, from Jon Stewart?
Yes, as someone who really only keeps up with The Daily Show, I don't know that I can answer that question in full. But I do think that it's important for candidates to have exposure on entertainment shows in addition to the Sunday talk shows or the more conventional political venues.
Is it interesting which ones they pick? That Hillary obviously feels comfortable with Letterman. Obama gravitates toward Oprah, who's an outspoken, open supporter to a degree that none of the other hosts is. And that the Hollywood, more conservative types wind up with Leno. What's going on there? What does it mean, if anything?
I don't have, honestly, an absolute answer to that, but I can speculate. And part of it may be the audience that these, the local audience, the on-site audience that these talk show hosts have, that may be more supportive. You know, even though I wouldn't expect that there would be a kind of partisan slant to the audience of a Jay Leno show, right? And so there, I would expect them to some degree there's some personal rapport. And certainly, I think that Jay Leno, Jon Stewart, you know, all of these talk show hosts, they actually get some cachet from having these presidential candidates on their show as well. So there's a kind of mutual benefit between them. I don't think we can say necessarily why candidates gravitate towards one host over the other without asking either David Letterman or Hillary. It's not clear to me. I haven't seen anything that would address that.
I think it's also a means of expanding their primary audience. Hillary Clinton, for example, has made appearances on The View and on Ellen, and I think in going on those shows, she's trying to find a population of women who can connect with her in perhaps ways that some male candidates cannot. I'd have a hard time imagining Mitt Romney on The View, for example.
That's an interesting thought. Who disconnects? Women are more likely to show up at the polls than men. So are those who don't try to reach out and make that connection, however awkwardly they might end up doing it, really messing up?
That's an interesting question. I think that candidates are making strategic decisions to the best of their ability. And so if your candidate is going to be completely uncomfortable in front of a particular audience, then it's probably wise that candidate not show up in that forum. And so for Romney, if we use our hypothetical example, there are other ways that he can reach out to women voters who, in more conservative forums, churchgoers, religious forums, where he can perhaps then reach a very targeted and specialized audience that will respond to his particular agenda without perhaps raising difficult questions on core values or other things that he might not want to address.
But can it be a real error at times not to try to reach out beyond your comfort zone of your core constituencies? What makes me think of that is recently how the PBS and NPR debate that was hosted by Tavis Smiley got completely ignored by four of the front-running Republican candidates. I mean, was an opportunity really egregiously missed there.
You know, Bob, it's interesting that you raised that point. I absolutely agree with you, and I think that because race is such a prominent issue, and because of Republican Party's stance on race is not always absolutely clear to African-American voters. And, you know, African-American voters are 85% vote for the Democratic Party, but George Bush did get small percentages of African-American voters in both of his campaigns. And we see a rising number of African-Americans who are identifying as independents and not as Democrats in the traditional way that they have since the 1930s. And also, African-Americans, based on survey data, are in many ways socially conservative, religious. They are a potential avenue for the Republican Party. And I do think it was a missed opportunity for Republicans. And it's very unlike what Democrats did. Democrats showed up for the debates at Howard University in the summer. All of them showed up, and all of them addressed the issues of race and transition in this country. So I do think it was a missed opportunity. Now, I will say that perhaps strategically, you know, if you think you're only going to get 8 or 10% and you think you're going to get those votes regardless of what you do, then perhaps it won't cost them as much. But I think in terms of a national dialogue, and this is something that citizens should consider, in terms of advancing a national dialogue, then that just egregious dismissal of that set of debates is problematic.
I think that the Republicans can afford to neglect African-American voters at this point, too, because the primary demographic in question for them is evangelical voters and the conservative bloc. That community, I think, is more of interest in for them than African-Americans at this point.
But at the same time, first of all, they blew off a similar venue that was run by and geared toward Latino constituencies. No showed on the debate, which I think was run by Univision, the major Spanish language television network in this country, which has more consistent ratings power than CW or my network, incidentally. It outdraws two of the English language networks. They blew that one off, too. And between the two, they blew off something like, if my count's any good, about 70 million individuals, probably 40 million of whom are adults of voting age. Is that a real miscalculation at this stage?
You know, I think in the way that perhaps we should think about it is really what Americans want from their candidates. Strategically, I think it was a low-cost miss for the Republican candidates, because the payoff of showing up at a debate at Morgan State, a historically black college, in Maryland, for Republican candidates is probably fairly low, except that it demonstrates that they actually are sensitive to these kinds of issues. And I think Americans should demand that of their, or should at least consider demanding that of their presidential candidates, in the same way that they should pay attention to issues that are important to other categories of people. But strategically, I don't think so in terms of cost, because right now candidates are focused on who's going to show up at those primaries, those early primaries and caucuses. These are activists, and as Stephanie points out, evangelical Christians are the folks that the Republican nominee actually has to pay attention to. And what they really need to be concerned about, as we've seen in the last few days, is whether or not their conservative base is going to bolt if Giuliani wins the nomination, the Republican nomination, and what the cost will be then in the general election in November.
It gets really complicated when you do the calculus of interests and voting constituencies, in a sense. Although I'm reminded of something Tip O'Neill, the late House Speaker, once said. You always got a chance of getting somebody's vote, at least if you ask for it.
Right.
So if you don't ask for it, you're not going to get it, right?
No, I agree with you. And so, again, I think if candidates are being strategic about where they spend their money, where they spend their resources, how they spend their time, and I think they're actually sending a signal by not showing up at these events, then citizens need to make some demands, at least those who are concerned about those kinds of issues need to raise an outcry about the lack of presence at those events.
263 WXXI, we have Bob in Rochester on the line. Hello, Bob, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Robert. Great program. I don't know, my question is this. We have all these, like, eight candidates, but when it comes down to walking into the voting booth, there's only going to be two names, one for each party. And sometimes it's picked from the party convention. Now, I haven't done the research, but I often wonder, of all the people running, how many, you know, really finally make it? And are these people considering this situation that when we come to the voting booth, there's going to be one from each party, even though they may be very popular with the polls and everything else? I'll take the answers off the air.
Okay, well, thanks very much for, in a sense, are we dealing with a winnowing process now that's going to circumscribe our choices 13 months from now? And how much do we have to say about that winnowing process?
Absolutely, we're dealing with the winnowing process. One way to think about this is the stage that we're in now is called the invisible primary. This is the primary before the public invisible primary where citizens actually cast their votes, right? So this is a primary that's based on how much money candidates raise and how successful they are. And so we've already seen some dropouts in the Democratic Party, and we're likely to see more. One of the ways that John McCain is framed is coming back from the dead, because he had run out of money in the first quarter and now has raised money, $5 million or so, in the second quarter. And so, yes, absolutely, the caller is right. When it comes to the general election, there are only going to be, presumably, one candidate from each of the two major parties, and we're not sure whether or not there's going to be an independent campaign. And that's, even winning an independent campaign at this point is going to be terribly difficult. Part of it, honestly, is that once the primary campaign actually starts, it is so front-loaded at this point. The whole primary calendar is being compressed for both Democrats and Republicans. So the nominee will essentially be decided by early February, late January. We will have the majority of delegates probably for both political parties.
Our primary is on February 5th. Is that effectively going to be the day of decision at least on one party, if not both?
Thereabouts. When I looked at the primary calendar, half of the Democratic delegates will be decided by February 10th. So that next weekend will be decided. There's a week between January 29th and February 5th where I think 20 states their decisions are going to be made. So it's a very truncated calendar, and what it means for us as voters is that once we move into the Iowa caucuses and the new Hampshire primary, the first four states, and then to add Florida to the mix or Michigan to the mix, once we move into those early states, there's going to be such a bandwagon effect. The people are talking about now is a slingshot. Whoever wins early is going to be just kind of tossed into such front-runner status. It's going to be very difficult to catch up.
Which is why also that this period of time right now is so important. I think that even though the campaign season has been elongated, we're also witnessing the fact that the critical importance of periods of time are being highlighted, that right now I think is going to be more critical than following all of the primaries.
Okay, so let's figure out how much valid material we've been given to work with as we prepare to make those choices, even if we're not going to get to formally make them until February 5th. Talking with Valeria Sinclair Chapman and Stephanie Lee of the University of Rochester, who are putting together the special undertaking of the Humanities Project entitled Politics and Media Construction, Anticipating the 2008 Election. I'm Bob Smith. You've got 1370 Connection on WXXI. And looking at it right now, have we made available to us the kind of information that we really need to make an intelligent and informed choice in our respective parties, first of all?
I think in some ways the information is available. We have to look for it, so it's not going to show up on the evening news. You may get a glimpse of it on one of the major news channels, and you may get a few minutes of it every night, maybe on news shows on NPR or WXXI. And so in some ways, citizens, voters are going to have to search. There are some fairly neat search engines on the Washington Post or New York Times or Wall Street Journal, where you can actually compare the candidates' positions on issues. You can look at how much fundraising they've done. But the lead stories that we're going to get on network news and in the newspapers are going to be those stories that are around the horse race issues, or the horse race campaign. Who's in front? Who's faster? Who's rising? An interesting story that's kind of headlining today is about Ron Paul as a dark horse candidate. I mean, I think he doesn't even have 10% of the vote in Iowa, in an Iowa caucus. But he's being presented now as a dark horse candidate because he alone among Republican candidates actually increased his coffers in the second quarter. Again, it's a curious news story about someone, and I'm not disparaging Ron Paul, so for those people who support Ron Paul, I'm not saying anything against him at all. He might be a perfectly fine candidate and president potential, but the way the media is framing him is really as this potential dark horse when there's no other evidence supporting that in terms of support across the country or even in Iowa and New Hampshire.
Is that an odd criterion on which to base the viability of a campaign? Not necessarily his issue positions, whether or not they seem to be connecting with a significant number of voters, but how much money he's getting?
I don't necessarily think so. So we certainly can rightfully have some concerns about how much money it costs to run a successful presidential or even congressional campaign. I think that we should rightfully question that and maybe consider other ways to increase publicly financed elections. But one of the ways that just kind of loosely the Supreme Court has interpreted this is that in some sense donations, cash donations, are actually a method of speech, right? So you say, you identify whether you support candidates based on the money that you give them. And so we don't want to erode that too significantly either. So there is a relationship between candidates who can raise money and what those people with resources who, frankly, generally vote at higher levels, there's a relationship between who they donate money to and who they think is electable and whether they think those issues are relevant and important and whether that candidate has the right position on those issues.
But tying back to something that you said a moment ago about how the horse race tends to get front and center in most reporting on most of the media outlets that we have most access to, why do you think we now have to work harder to get substantive information about these candidates and what they do in office than it seems we used to?
Because I think we're experiencing a conflation between politics and entertainment, and it becomes responsibility of the voters then to look beyond the headlines and say, to examine some of the comparative websites that do exist, for example, on the Washington Post or the New York Times, in which you can track the different stances that candidates take on a variety of issues, and also how much money they've raised, where those donations are coming from, how much money they've spent, because there is also a discrepancy to be made between how much money a campaign receives and how much they're spending. So, for example, Mitt Romney is he's spending more money than he's received through donations because he's putting so much of his own money into his campaign.
But at the same time, of course, there was a time when the media did more of that work for us and put the candidates in relief against each other and against a set of criteria and a set of issues that they determined mostly through polling were the issues we worried about most. Now we got to do that work ourselves. How many people are actually inclined to do that kind of work and have the time to do that kind of work?
Well, I mean, I think on like the evening news, I think that hard news stories are being kind of squeezed out. And in terms of people's inclination to actually do this work, it's probably not very high. So the people who are going to do the work are already probably the most informed. The rest of the country is going to make their decisions kind of following the pack, a kind of bandwagon effect that we see routinely in political science research. And so they're going to probably go with whoever's already in front. I mean, in some ways, I think that newspapers are trying to present the issues. So we do hear about health care plans and comparisons among the Democrats and the Republicans, but that's not front page news anymore in general. And so we have to, if citizens are to be informed, we have to take on some of that responsibility ourselves. We cannot simply say to the media establishment, as important as they are, we cannot let that be their responsibility. We have to take some of that responsibility on ourselves.
As voters, we have to remember that the media's primary concern is to sell more newspapers or to sell more ad space, and their interest will not always coincide with our own.
So I guess we have to do the work. Our thanks to our guests of the hour from the University of Rochester faculty, Valeria Sinclair Chapman and Stephanie Lee, for setting it all in perspective and helping us out and understanding as we go into campaign 2008 exactly what we have to do and maybe exactly what we're up against. Thank you both for being with us this hour. And thank you all for being with us on this edition of 1370 Connection here at WXXI AM 1370, WXXI FM HD2 Rochester. For Dave Campo, our technical director, I'm Bob Smith. It's been a pleasure.